This is the Australian Butchers Guild podcast, brought to you by Meat and Livestock Australia, the podcast for passionate butchers.
G'day everyone, and thanks for listening in to the Australian Butchers Guild podcast. I'm your host, Doug Piper. Today we're catching up with well-known butcher and famous sausage king and owner of Edwards Family Butchers, Mark Edwards. Before we catch up with Mark, I need to remind you to get your point of sale orders in for the Greatest Butcher on Your Block campaign. There's another great in-store promotion where your customers will have the chance to win the major prize of a magical trip to Uluru or one of 100 Philips air fryers. This promotion has our 30 minutes meals cookbook that's loaded with 20 air fryer friendly recipes and some new value added recipes for you to try in store. And the best part about it is free. It will cost you absolutely nothing. Use the competition to attract new and old customers back to your stores by promoting the giveaway on your social pages. All your customers have to do is purchase beef or lamb and you give them the entry form. It's as simple as that. The Greatest Butcher campaign is shaping up to be one of our biggest yet, and thanks to everyone for placing your orders in early. The rest of you have just over a week until the 28th of January to get your orders in. If you haven't received your notification for the competition or want to join up, drop me an email at butchers@mla.com.au and we'll make sure you're added to the competition database. This independent retail butcher program is supported by MLA and the Beef and Lamb Producers of Australia. But before we get into it, I've got one other extremely important topic to cover for all our butcher mates listening in over there in cold and frosty UK. And that's the Ashes cricket test. Anyway, I think that just about covers everything there. About 13 years ago, Mark Edwards decided to make a sea change and headed north to the central coast of New South Wales. Edwards Family Butchers have a long history in the meat industry and have been trading since 1925. Mark's a third generation butcher and his sons Max and Luke are fourth generation and work between their two stores in Woi Woi and East Gosford. Mark has had a reputation for having some of the best and most interesting ranges of sausages for over 20 years and has won a stack of trophies from the AMIC Sausage King regional, state and national events, as well as gold, silver and bronze medals for many of his sausages and small goods at the Royal Agricultural Society Food Awards. The most memorable winner for Mark is his beef chili con carne sausage that was named Champion of Champions at the RAS a few years back. So if you're having trouble with your sausages, Mark is a bloke to see. Welcome, Mark.
G'day, Doug. Thanks for having me.
No worries, mate. Great to see you again. How's everything going for you?
Very good, thanks.
You survived the Christmas rush and ordeal of the Central Coast with all the tourists up there?
Only just. Yeah, popped out some pretty big hours.
I can imagine. Yeah, I've heard a few stories where a lot of people have had some big ones, and there's been a couple of guys that have done some extraordinary hours over the Christmas time. So yeah, part of the job I don't miss, that's for sure. So Mark, the sausage king, you've got such a reputation for such a long time with the Sausage King Awards, with the AMIC Sausage King events, as well as the RAS, mate. So going backwards towards when you first started out in business, mate, what was your business plan with your first butcher shop that you had?
Business plan? I don't know. I was 28 and I was going to start a shop, or my father and I were going to start a shop at Castle Hill. I was 23. And the weekend we were going to take over, I was at Grafton water ski racing and I paralysed my arm up there. So I had to start all over again and learn the trade again one-handed.
Wow. So that's where it all started for you. That's where you had your accident.
Yeah, that was going to be the first shop, but it threw a little bit of a spanner in the works for a little while.
And, yeah, right.
Until I got back on my feet.
Wow.
I was in hospital and I was off work for 6 weeks before I started butchering again, and I had to really learn my trade all over again. So I didn't actually get the first shop until 1989 at Terry Hills.
Ah, right, Terry Hills. Yeah, I had a shop at Collaroy Plateau. And,
okay.
And I heard it. There was a story going around of this guy, Terry Hills, who had limited mobility with one arm. Yeah. And typical butchers back then, you know, we kept to ourselves. I actually drove up there and I looked through the window and bang, there was this bloke standing there and he was only using one arm. And I was only probably 24, 25. And I went back to my shop and I said to the guy, that story's right. That guy up there at Terry Hills has only got the use of one arm. So, you know, that's when I first heard about you. I didn't know, obviously, your name or anything, but butchers back then were very much to themselves, didn't they?
Yeah, they were quite standoffish.
Very.
Well, in some ways, but yeah, I would agree. They try to keep things under their own hat. They didn't really share their ideas around much.
So from Terry Hills, where did you go from there?
I got divorced, and then I got out of butchering for a while. I've been in real estate twice. Once for 2 years. That was just after I paralysed my arm. Probably 2 years after I paralysed my arm, I thought there might be something easier than being a one-handed butcher. So I went and sold real estate for 2 years, and then I went and bought the shop at Terry Hills. And then I got divorced, and I went back to real estate for 4 years, and then I ended up buying a shop after that in the Whitsundays off my father. I was looking for shops while I was selling real estate because I just wanted to get back to my trade. I think it's just in me. And I was speaking to Dad. Dad wanted to sell, and I couldn't find a shop that I wanted in Sydney. And he said, look, this is a great business. So we went up and took it on.
Wow.
And I was there for 4 years and then came back to Sydney and bought a shop at Warunga.
You have had a few shops over
the years.
I've
had nine.
You had nine. Did you have many at one time, or were they all one?
Never more than two at a time.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a mistake.
Yeah.
I just get bored, like testing myself and pushing myself, and I've taken on other shops. Sometimes it's worked really well, sometimes it hasn't. It just depends on who you've got working with you and how much time you have, but it can be difficult.
Yeah, definitely.
I was listening to your last podcast, and the guy had four or five shops, and he's a braver man than me.
Yes, it's these days it does take a brave man to take on so many shops.
Or very well organised.
Yeah, you've got to be, and the way that the lack of labour at the moment, it certainly makes it very how do I put it?
It's very hard.
Very hard, yeah, extremely hard, because you know butchers tend to leave. They come and they go. You know, we have some butcher shops have a large turnover of staff. Others they're quite stable. Where butchers stay for, you know, 5, 10, 15, I don't know, a guy that's only just lost somebody after about, I think it was about 30 years he's worked with him. They've worked together. So, you know, it's a big hole when you lose those key people in your business.
Totally.
Over the years, you developed a huge range of sausages. What gave you the inspiration to go that way? Was it the way that it actually happened, or was it a plan that you put together?
Well, what happened was, Because I can't use my left hand, or not properly, it's very hard for me to do intricate value adding. But by the same token, it's not hard for me to work out a recipe like it was originally. I used to make things and think, oh, they're going to be great, and they are total failures. So I've had a lot of failures before I've had success. But originally, going back when I had the shop at Terry Hills, I went and worked with a fellow, it was a family friend, David Russell, an English fellow, down in Glenferrie Road, Hawthorne. I went down there and worked with him for a week. He taught me a few of the sausages he was making, and I used those as a base. And like, to be honest, I employed a guy from a Danishman actually, by the name of Ollie Larsen, when I had the shop in the Whitsundays, because I was trying to learn more about small goods and sausage manufacturing. I couldn't find anyone up there, and he was retired in Cairns, and I flew him down, worked with him for a week, and he taught me that everything starts with a base. Once you've got a base started, like, it can be very similar for nearly everything you make, and then you build on that. So to be honest now, what I used to do was I'd go through, I've got countless sausage making books. I've studied the net as much as I can with my limited computer knowledge, and I've been through it so much. But now what I do is I'll look at cookbook recipes, and I'll convert a cookbook recipe to a sausage. And well, the one we won Champion of Champions in the Royal Easter Show a little while back with a chili con carne. And actually, one of the guys from AMIC was one of the judges and didn't realise it was mine. And quite a few of the chefs there couldn't work out how I could make a sausage taste like a chili con carne. And it's just a matter of reading the recipe and working it backwards.
Exactly, mate. I've tried that chili con carne sausage, mate, and it is an absolute cracker of a sausage.
Thank you.
If you closed your eyes, you think you're having chili con carne. Simple as that.
Well, that's what Craig from Australian Ministry Council said.
Yeah.
He couldn't believe it, which is good.
I remember many years ago I was selling sausage casings, I went to this bloke called Mark Edwards up there at, I think it might have been West Lee.
Yeah, West Lee shop.
Yeah, the West Lee shop. And I saw in your window a sausage called Everything But the Kitchen Sink.
Mm.
And I've never forgotten that. I have never forgotten that sausage.
The reason that came into play, Doug, is because, say, like sometimes I'll make 25 different types. And we used to make it into rissoles. Like each time you're pushing something out, there's always a little bit left in the filler. And the rissole didn't sell that well. So anyway, I thought, bugger it, what can I do? I'll make it into a sausage. And I thought, what's the best name? Well, it is Everything But the Kitchen Sink. It's it could have crocodile in it, emu, kangaroo, beef, lamb, pork, veal. So it's pretty nondescript and it's not overly consistent, but I put it on a little bit cheaper and it sells every week. I can't get enough of them, to be honest. And
yeah, I thought that was such a great idea to do that with them, because like you said, normally we'd mix whatever not many guys will do 25 different varieties a week, but not back then. So you might have three or four or five or whatever, and then you'd sort of, whatever was left over, you mixed up with a big sausage batch, and then you made rissoles or whatever with them. But they actually go to fill them out. They were probably not the best looking sausage in the window, because they were all different coloured. Definitely a different taste every mouthful.
Like a licorice all sort.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Layer upon layer.
So your family history goes back to, I was reading today, 1925?
Well, that was my grandfather's first shop, from what we can deduce. He had a fairly checkered life. He started on a meat cart when he was 12 years old. I'm pretty sure it's 1907, and he was born in the late 1800s. And, yeah, he had numerous shops. He used to buy them, build them up and sell them, basically. And, yeah, he did very well out of it. Then my father came along and Dad went into it at 15. I'm pretty sure that may have been a shop in Auburn that he had. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack, my grandfather, had numerous shops over the time. And Dad worked for him for a while, but they used to fight a bit, so Dad left him and went and worked all over the place. And then Dad started his own shop at 25 at Roseville Chase, as you come up the hill coming from French's Forest. Just on the left-hand side, there used to be a little butcher shop there, and that was Dad's. It wasn't a butcher shop. He turned it into a butcher shop.
Right, okay.
And then he went from there to West Pimble. And Dad actually had, at one stage, he had five shops when I was younger. He's all over the place. Carlingford, Epping, Beecroft, St. Ives. And he was looking after my grandfather, well retired, but he still owned a butcher shop in Kingsgrove. So I used to look after that as well. So that was a bit of a pain trying to get to from the north side of Sydney.
Yeah, it would have been for sure, especially at peak hour.
And then Dad eventually, he retired and at 52. And he bought a couple of bear boats and went up to the Whitsundays with Mum. And he was just running these bear boats. And the income wasn't great. And he was approached by one of the young fellas up there who he knew from family friends. And he ended up going partners with the guy. And the shop really kicked off, because they ended up getting a lot of restaurant trade over on the islands, Hamilton Island, all over the place. Mm-hmm. And he really got it going. And then he was back in harness till he was 62. And then he wanted to get out. And that's what I was looking. And I got a call and ended up there. I bought the shop off him.
Yeah, right. You've got the two boys, Max and Luke. They're both butchers as well.
Yep. They're both going well. They're both big, strong kids, and they both... I still bone and break bodies. The boys are both quite competent at that. Max is like a thrashing machine. He goes through it very quickly. Luke's good. He's not quite as quick as his big brother, but his big brother's 110, 115 kilos, and just... I don't think he even needs a knife. He can just pull it apart.
It must be extremely gratifying to see your two boys coming into the trade, to take up after your grandfather, your father, and yourself. So four generations of butchers in the one family.
There was a proviso on them coming into the trade, though.
Oh, really?
I told them that they had to save their money, and by the time they were 18, they had to buy a property. I didn't care where it was in Australia, as long as they bought something to get their foot in the door, and they both done it. They both got units in Gosford, three-bedroom units.
Oh, good on him.
Lukey was, I think, 18 or 19 when he got his. 19, probably. And Maxie was 20.
Well done.
They're doing well. Yeah, I think it's important for kids to do what they can with whatever they've got.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got the two shops up here. You've got Woi Woi in East Gosford. So the boys look after the East Gosford shop, or?
Maxie looks after East Gosford. Luke only really works over there 1 or 2 days a week. Max is there full time, and he's doing a brilliant job. The shop's going quite well. We're all, I don't know about other butchers at the moment, we're all trading quite well because Woolworths have got a bit of a drama. They're not getting all their supplies out.
Yeah, I think all of them, it's not just the retail supermarket chains, it's also, you know, the wholesalers, the processors. You know, this time of the year we often see a lot of a lack of stock out there, and it's probably compounded even worse this year because of COVID and all the shutdowns around the place. So everybody seems to be suffering at the moment, but thank goodness the butcher shops are still out there with reasonably full cool rooms and can get enough stock to keep the customers coming back.
Yeah, it is awkward at the moment, very awkward. You just got to think a bit in advance and make sure you have got plenty of stock.
So, Mark, you're still breaking beef bodies.
Yes, we are, mate, yeah. Roughly 6 to 7 at Woi Woi and only about 2 at East Gosford, plus we buy a bit of carton meat as well.
Yeah, okay. So you had much trouble getting the fresh carcasses in, or...?
It hasn't been as good as it has been. It's a bit difficult at the moment. What I've told my wholesalers is, see, I usually carry my beef over, so I'll get it in on the Monday and then break it on the Sunday. But I've told the guys, I've given them a bit more leeway. They can get it to me whenever they want, whether it be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or even Friday, just to make it a bit easier. Because it is it's a bit hard at the moment because a lot of abattoirs have actually closed down. So. Mm. It's quite difficult.
Yeah, I was just wondering if there was a better supply of fresh beef around rather than carton beef, that's all, but it's obviously impacting on everything.
Yeah, it is. Even cartons, I'm struggling to get the cartons I wanted. I wanted to get some great rumps today, and they said, look, I might have some in on Thursday. This was Johnson's, which is a very big company.
Oh, well, we've got to roll with the punches, mate.
That's exactly right.
You've got plenty of sausages to sell out there as long as you can get trim. And
yeah, I've made...
And all that other sort of...
25 or so different types today. I made all the pre-mixes up today, yeah.
Oh, okay. So what's Wednesday, the big sausage day?
Yeah, Wednesday I mix and mince everything and the boys fill them out.
So you said before when you're making sausages, you use a base. Everything starts with a base. Do you have obviously your own recipes and then you work from there?
What I do, Doug, is there's numerous bases you can use. You could use... I use potato starch on some things, mainly with chicken. It seems to work well with chicken. I use rice flour with other things. I make fail-safe sausages from scratch, like for people with allergies. You can use like a pork premix is quite a good base. It's fairly nondescript as far as flavour. It's not too doesn't over overpower anything. Some things need a rice flour base because if they're a bit wetter, the potato starch doesn't soak it up quite as much. I've noticed. I use lots of different things.
I actually made some sausages on the week or a couple of weeks ago at home. I like to make my ring stingers, my Mexican sausages.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since I've made them. Probably been about 12 months odd since I've made them. And I had eight kilos of meat run through the mincer. And everything I do, I write down the recipe, right? So whether I'm doing 2 kilo batch, a 4 kilo batch, an 8 kilo batch or whatever, it's never much more than 8 kilos. Yeah. Stupid me, doing an 8 kilo batch, read off a 2 kilo batch. So,
oh no.
Yeah. Sorry. So, and I didn't realize this until after I'd filled them out, and I couldn't work out. When I was running it through the mince, I thought, geez, it's really dry, you know. And so I added a little bit more water, thinking that'll be okay. And as they sat, like, you know, I linked them all. They looked great. They smelt great. They looked the part. They had all the usual stuff in it, except for the meal and a little bit of water. So. They sat in the. I put them in the bottom of the fridge in my beer fridge and the crisper there to harden up and to settle. But a lot of water came out of them, and I'm thinking, why did so much water come out of them? And that's when it made me go back and look at my recipe, and then I realised there wasn't enough base in there. There wasn't enough meal in there to absorb the water.
What do you use?
I use a continental bratwurst meal as my base.
Okay.
Because it's got a really nice flavour. It's got a different sort of flavour. I think it's the aniseed and the other bits and pieces that are in it. And from there, I just add from that. But I did not use enough. I think I put about maybe 300 grams of meal in it all up. And that's when I realised it was obviously too late.
Well, there's not enough binder to bind it.
No. But I couldn't work. That's what made me look, because I noticed the amount of moisture coming out of the sausages. Nothing. It wasn't retaining it. And even though I'd worked off a 2 kilo batch, a lot of that, and I put in probably, it might have only been a couple of hundred grams of water, but yeah, just making silly mistakes like that. I'm excused because I wasn't selling them, and nobody was hurt in the making of these Mexican sausages. But that's the thing is making sure that you write down those recipes. I suppose make sure you know you're sticking to them and being methodical in the way that you put them together.
I don't know whether you've seen my recipe book, have you?
I've seen your recipe book, mate. You showed it to me.
Everything I do everything exactly the same. Like whether you like McDonald's or not, they follow a system and it's the same everywhere you go, and that's what I try and achieve each time. I want them to be the same. Sometimes the meat's slightly different, and it mightn't absorb as well as other times. But you know, if it's lean enough and everything else, the mycin and the meat should come out when you're mixing and bind it together a bit anyway. So as I said before, you can use either potato starch or rice flour, or if you wanted to, a pork premix or something that's fairly nondescript, so it's not going to sort of dominate any of the flavors. And say you want to make a chicken sausage, there's a couple of ways of doing it. You could use, say you're making a 5 kilo batch, you could use 400 grams of potato starch, 120 grams of chicken booster, and I use Emel Cut as another binder just to help it bind so that it doesn't come out the ends. And then you could build up from there. Like say, you could make a very simple one. Chicken and parsley was one I first started off with. And I used to just use dried parsley and the chicken booster, and the chicken with the parsley give it quite a nice taste. It was quite simple and easy. But if you use that base, like say 400 grams, 120 grams, if you didn't want to use a chicken booster, you can use salt. You just have to be careful on how much you use. It will still bind quite well with salt. Just, I'd say, 400 grams of potato starch and roughly up to 100 grams of salt, depending on what you're doing. If you go much more than that, it starts to get a little bit much for people that don't take much salt. And then you go to your recipe books and just add whatever you want. Now, As a rule, I will look at some spices, and some spices you can't go too much of. Say if it's nutmeg or mace or something like that. If I was doing a 5 kilo batch, I wouldn't go much more than, say, if it's nutmeg, say, depending on how dominant you want it to taste, I usually use probably 4 to 5 grams. Mace, same thing. Black pepper, you could use up to 20 grams. It only stops where your imagination stops. So, like I do a Thai green chicken curry sausage, which my wife made for the family for years, and she asked me if I could put it together as a sausage because we're going to a dinner party, and she can't help herself. Everyone was supposed to take one dish, she took three. And anyway, I made them, and we made them into chipolatas. It is a Thai green curry. It's got jasmine rice, it's got fish sauce, it's got green curry paste in it, it's got beans, it's also got chicken booster, it's got emel cut as a binder. If you're using, say, a 5 kilo batch, I'd use 12.5 grams of emel cut. So I'm giving away too many secrets now. But yeah, look at your cookbooks. Look at sausage recipes that are there that you can find in old books, and you can use that as a base on pork, beef, just about anything. If you're finding it's not binding well with the potato starch, use rice flour. It'll bind a bit hard. It binds a bit better with beef and lamb than it does with pork or the chicken or whatever.
Yeah, I like doing the reverse. I'll go out and I'll look at recipes for cuisines that I like, and I love Asian food, Thai food and all that, and I look at the recipes there, and a lot of that does have pork and a lot of chicken in it, but I then reverse that and I use it with beef. So we did some Thai coconut beef meatballs, and generally they're made with chicken, but all I did was just replaced the chicken with beef, and I tell you, they came out really good.
I do a Thai red beef, and with that, it makes it a lot easier. I have done it with straight rice flour, but I usually use pork premix as a base. Obviously, each premix is different, but I use about 625 grams to a 5 kilo batch, and that binds really well. And then you can add your fish sauce and your red curry paste and whatever else you want to add rice to. Rice is quite good because it actually bulks it out quite a bit, and rice is very cheap.
Yeah.
So
there you go, boys.
That's where I find that some of the premixes I make, like I make a Sicilian pork sausage, To make a 5 kilo batch would probably cost me $1.50 for the premix that I make up.
Yeah, right.
And to make a 10 kilo batch is $3.
Yeah,
so pretty good. If that.
So you also mentioned something about value adding. I know sausages are your form of value adding because trying to play with pastries is a little bit difficult.
We have done a lot of pastries. I've had various different guys that have come in and done various different pastries. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time they'll come in and they don't really want to show anyone else. And then they'll go. So that knowledge is lost, which is my fault. But in value adding, I do a lot of different things. Like I'll make liver treats for dogs in the smokehouse. I do jerky. I do biltong. I do drywurst. Mm-hmm. I do my own bacon, my own hams, kranskis, chorizos, frankfurts, cabanossi. Basically, I do everything from scratch with those two, with the small goods. Ole Larsen, the fellow, the Danishman I mentioned, he taught me how to make up my own salt cure. So I do all of that myself. Mm-hmm. I make nitrite-free bacon, and the way I come up with that was I basically started studying the net, and I was looking at mainly American sites. It's all the cowboys over in the States making all the different things, and I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, with all my sausage knowledge and spice knowledge, I should be able to infuse some flavour in it with what I've learnt. Mm. And I did, and we were selling a lot of that. I was doing markets at Gosford, and I was selling a stack of nitrate-free bacon.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't seem to sell quite as well in the butcher shop as such, because I haven't got as many greeny types coming into the shop, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the markets tend to attract a different clientele, don't they?
Totally. Very different, yeah.
So when you're making your snags also, what's your go-to? You use a natural casing or a collagen casing?
I do collagen casings on our thin snags, mainly because of price, to be honest. Thin snags, as far as plain. With the thick and thin sausages that I make for the gourmet snags, I use natural casings. I use a 26-28 for the thin ones and a 32-34 for the thick ones. I use a young bloke by the name of Nick from the Casing Boutique.
Oh, yeah.
He does a very good job. I mean, any problems, he sorts it out, which is good.
There are quite a few different sausage casing companies around, but they seem to be... Yeah, and plus also then you got your dry stock suppliers as well.
That's right, yeah.
I also remembered when we were talking about value adding, beef and beer salami?
Beerwurst.
Beerwurst, yes. How did you come up with that one?
Taught to me by Ollie Larsen again.
Right, okay.
Cost me about $1,000 back, $1,200. 1996 or 97 when I was up in the Whitsundays. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, "You're crazy spending that sort of money." But to be honest, it's been totally worth it. He stayed at our place. He worked from 6 o'clock in the morning till about 3:30 in the afternoon. And he was a great big fella. Wore his clogs when he was in a great big white apron and white coat. Yep. And then he would leave the shop and I'd finish at 5:30 and he'd go to the tavern for a couple of hours. And then he'd come back and we'd feed him. So, yeah, he stayed for a week. It was good value.
Yeah, yeah. As I said, I think I said in one of my previous podcasts, I worked for a German small goodsman down in DY on the Northern Beaches there many years ago. I think I was probably maybe in my third year of my apprenticeship. A guy called Otto Simon. And what he didn't know, you didn't need to know, because he's such a great small goods person. And to try and get a recipe out of him, you couldn't get it because it's all up in his head. So I remember my dad used to say to me, when Otto's out there putting all the recipes together, go out there and write down what he's putting in there. But Otto was a bit smarter than that. He'd say, "Doug, go do the mince while I put the stuff together." So I'd be out there on the other side of the shop running the mince through the mincer or the silent cutter or whatever. Or putting the big filler together, and then he'd be out there mixing up everything that he needed to, and all he came out with was a big white jug. One thing I did notice, we used to go through a lot of white wine.
Okay.
And I didn't know if that went into the small goods or into him, because by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he was pretty well shot nearly every day. But a lot of white wine did go into his small goods.
Yeah.
There's a shop up there in Taree, up the mid-north coast of New South Wales, and there's a butcher there, a German small goodsman there called Rudy.
I know Rudy.
I think he's going to shut down this year.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Very, very knowledgeable man. He tried to sell me the shop, but it's too hard to get out of two shops and then go up there to Taree, and my wife wasn't keen, so
No, yeah.
I would have loved to have done that. Like now I'm 61. I'm still learning, but to uproot and do that at the moment, it's a bit hard. So.
Yeah, it's such a pity because a lot of these guys, we're losing that these fellas. That they're just like Rudy's retiring, and I don't blame him. He's worked damn hard for what he's got.
He's
in his 70s. He's in his 70s, is he? Yeah.
His hands are pretty a bit crippled up.
Yeah.
From obviously all the hard work he's done, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
But you know, that is a big loss. It's,
that knowledge.
I've got a quick little story with that. I had a guy from Safeway, big fella, come in years ago, and I can't remember which shop it was. And he went through Rudy Metgez, I think his surname is.
Yep.
He went through Rudy's shop, was going, trying to get into Rudy's shop, and there was a queue because they only opened certain days. There was a queue outside his shop, and he went to go to the front of the line. And this big German fella grabbed him and said, "Hey, you can't push in." And he said, "No, I'm from Safe Food." He said, "I don't care where you're from. Get to the back of the line." Threw him to the back of the line. And the guy went away, didn't come back until there was no one there. So, I wish that happened to me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of butchers out there going, "Yeah, that's where they belong, at the back of the line." No, but
some good ones out there.
That'll be such a loss, all that knowledge that he's got. I remember going in there many years ago, and I saw this like this meatloaf on his counter, and I think it might have been his wife or the lady that was serving there, and it was Lieberkäsen.
Lieberkäsen, beautiful stuff.
Otto used to make it, and we'd only make probably two or three a week in the little butcher shop where we worked, and I reckon we ate most of it. And when I tried, and I'd never been able to find it ever again, and when I went up there and when I dropped into Rudy's, the lady there said, "Would you like to try some?" I said, "Yes, please." And it brought back so many memories. It was so similar to the one that he had. But
yeah, that is
such a beautiful thing. I tried to make it once myself, and it was disgusting.
Anyone that's really looking to get into learning how to do a bit of small goods, when this COVID's all over, whenever, I did a course at Granville TAFE, mm-hmm. and I've done one at East Sydney. One was with Paul Anderson at East Sydney before it closed down there. And he was very, very knowledgeable. And the two guys at Granville, Ben and Andrew, they are really, really good. And Andrew's got that much knowledge about small goods. It's not funny. And very happy to teach you. If ever I've got any problems, I'll ring them. And they're always extremely willing to help.
Yeah, they're great fellas out there at Granville. Andrew is, you know, the go-to guy for a lot of fellas when it comes to small goods. And he even holds classes down there in Sydney, I think maybe once a month or something.
Yeah.
At, I think it's called Dalton House or some place like that down there where he teaches, where the public can go.
He's very passionate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He loves his smoking too. They've got their barbecue wars.
That's right. Yeah, they
well,
do
haven't
too.
They? Yeah.
Now, that's something I haven't really capitalised on. I'm not that clued in on the all the smoking. I can smoke just about any sausage or ham or whatever you want, but as far as the briskets and all that sort of thing, come the weekend, I don't really want to see a smokehouse. But I should learn more.
It's one of those things, like it's so popular that it's everybody's doing it.
It's a big thing now. It's a very, and it's actually a good thing for the industry.
Oh, it's massive.
A lot of these young blokes will come in and they're not frightened to spend $100, $150, just bang.
Exactly. Like, you know, you look at the price of a brisket, and I think we spoke with Trevor the other week, and, you know, there was a, you know, you see these pictures on social pages where they've got, they're showing what they cooked for the weekend. They must
have
had a couple of families where they've got a whole brisket there. They've got a couple of tomahawks, some short ribs, and whatever else they've cooked up. And it's like, crikey, that would have cost them a couple hundred bucks at the butcher.
Yeah, and they sort of try to outdo each other, all the different mates.
Yes, definitely do.
Great thing for the butchers.
It is. So mate, what are your thoughts on the trade and where it's heading? What do you think what's going to happen?
I think we're going to have to do more and more cooked products. The shop I've got now is not really geared for it. It's geared for it as far as doing the smoking and all that sort of thing. But to be honest, I actually many, many years ago at Terry Hills, and I should have kept going with it, I put a young bloke on cooking meals for me. That was back in 1989. That was something I learned from David Russell down in Glenferrie Road, Hawthorne. He had a chef working for him back then. And the chef was preparing meals, and they were putting them in litre containers, and Dave had half litre and litre containers that he was selling. He had all sorts of meals that they were doing, and he was way ahead of his time, to be honest. But really, I don't know, I think that's where it's heading. So people can come in, pick up their meal, they know it's going to be a quality product, and go home and just heat it up, because you don't want the takeaways taking all the business off us.
No, that's right. And also with the majors out there, the big retailers, you're seeing their range of cooked value-added products, not just on the butcher shop shelf, but in the freezer. That's what people are buying. And if the majors are doing it, we should be doing it too. But we can do it better. Butchers can do it better because they're using a fresher product. It's you know, hasn't been mass produced. It's been made with the love of a butcher's hand.
Exactly. Well, a couple of times I've posted things like people talk about not wanting too much plastic packaging. You go into Woolworths or Coles and there is so much packaging. It's packaging on top of packaging. I've started using, I can't think, whether they're bamboo or like trays that they can put in their green bin, if I'm packing something. The only thing they can't is the plastic bag I'm vacuuming it in.
Yeah.
We've got to start thinking about that way too, because a lot of people don't want all this extra plastic.
Yeah. Sustainability is very high on everybody's mind and the environment. So, you know,
totally.
Butchers have got to be wary of that. I think, you know, the best thing that's happened in this state is, and I think most of Australia, is the banning of the plastic carry bag. You know, and everybody's adjusted quite quickly. I thought, you know, they've all...
Some. I still have people, I put their meat in a paper carry bag, and then I'll go, could you put a plastic bag around that as well? And I think, it defeats the purpose. But anyway,
it certainly does, yeah.
You're the customer.
Oh, that's great. Well, mate, look, thanks a lot for your time tonight, Mark. I really appreciate having a chat to you.
That's great, Doug. Thanks for the opportunity.
No worries, mate. So I'll let you get on. You can go and have your dinner now. You've had a long day in the shop, and I'll catch up with you a little bit later in the week, mate.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Mark. If you missed any of our earlier podcasts, simply hit the subscribe button and you can keep up to date with all our other episodes. If you have an inquiry or want to know more about the Australian Butchers Guild, please drop me an email at butchers@mla.com.au. Thanks for supporting our Butchers Guild podcast, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next time. I'm Doug Piper.
You've been listening to the Australian Butchers Guild podcast, produced by The Sound Business.